Next, American Dream Radio brings you British author Luke Anderson. His talk is on the underreported battle over genetic engineering, food safety, and the WTO. Mr. Anderson is the author of the best-selling book, Genetic Engineering, Food, and Our Environment. This public talk was sponsored by the Ukiah Valley Alliance for Democracy in Ukiah, California, on May 29, 2003. It took place about 3 weeks before a planned meeting of the agricultural ministers of the WTO, June 23 through the 25th, 2003, in Sacramento, California. This is an original production of American Dream Radio. So, without any further ado, can I turn it over to you?
Thank you very much. Luke Anderson.
So, I'm currently touring around California in the run-up to the Sacramento mobilization that's happening between June the 20th and the 25th. And the reason that this mobilization is taking place, I'm going to go into a little bit during this talk, and I'm going to focus in particular on areas which I know a lot about, which are genetic engineering, the global food and economic system. But briefly, it's worth describing what this meeting that the government is having in Sacramento is all about. Between the 23rd and the 25th of June, the United States government will be hosting government ministers from around the world. It's invited government ministers from 180 different countries. It's as yet unclear quite how many will turn up. And the point of this meeting is for the United States to lay out its vision of global agricultural development. And that vision is one of which genetic engineering, food irradiation, free trade, corporate controlled agriculture are key elements. Also being discussed at this meeting are the privatization of the world's water resources. There will be various workshops where public-private water partnerships are to be discussed. And I know that's an issue that people in Northern California know quite a lot about because of the water bags issue that's been taking place in the past months. So this mobilization is really, I think, an extraordinarily strategic opportunity for people to mobilize. And one of the reasons I say this is because this meeting has been planned in the run-up to the WTO ministerial, the main WTO meeting that happens in Cancun in Mexico this September. And some analysts have suggested that the whole WTO process could actually unravel in Mexico this September because of continued failure to reach agreement on agriculture. And so this meeting is really a place where the United States is intending to gather support for its vision of agriculture and is inviting these ministers to meet together with a number of corporate representatives and top scientists in the field of industrial agriculture, pro-biotech scientists, for example, where the United States will try to persuade southern nations of the benefits of genetic engineering and high-tech agriculture dominated by U.S.-based multinational corporations. So let me hone in a bit on one of the things that's really going to be discussed a lot, which is the importance of genetic engineering to feed the world's population, at least according to the United States of America. What are we talking about? Genetic engineering, when I use this word, I'm referring to a set of molecular techniques that have only really been developed fully since the late 1980s. And these allow scientists to take DNA from any organism, a plant, a virus, an animal, an insect, a bacteria, even from a human, and engineer it into, say, a food crop to reproduce a desired characteristic. So an example of this, last year in San Diego, there were field trials of genetically engineered corn, engineered with human genes so that the corn plants contained a rare class of human antibodies that attack sperm. The idea being that these corn plants could then be used as some kind of plant gel contraceptive. And this engineering of plants and indeed animals so that they essentially operate as factories to produce industrial chemicals or pharmaceutical drugs is called Farming by the Industry, P-H-A-R-M-I-N-G. And farming, P-H-A-R, also extends to animals. I've been working a fair bit in New Zealand over the past years on this issue. And they have about 1,000 genetically engineered sheep there, also engineered with human genes, this time so that the sheep contain human protein called alpha-antitrypsin in their milk, so they can be milked for this pharmaceutical protein. And the spokesperson for PPL Therapeutics, the company behind this particular trial in New Zealand, described the sheep as little furry factories walking around in the field. A Canadian biotech company called Nexus has engineered goats with a spider silk gene so that they can be milked for the spider silk protein. And this could be used by the US military to develop protective clothing. So these are all examples of things that are currently being done with the use of genetic engineering that simply, clearly, cannot be done with traditional breeding practices. Yet, one of the things that the biotech industry likes to say is that this is just an extension of what we've been doing for thousands of years, and they point out that the vegetables and the fruits that we're eating bear little resemblance to their wild relatives, and indeed the domesticated animals. And of course it's true that we've been changing the genes of the plants and animals through breeding practices for thousands of years, but those changes have been made within strict limits, broadly speaking, the limits set by the normal processes of sexual reproduction. And genetic engineering really heads into new territory. Another thing that the biotech industry likes to say is that genetic engineering is an extremely precise science. And in fact, a lot of genetic engineering advocates say that it's far more precise than the messy process of sexual reproduction, where you just get thousands of genes mixing around. Well, again, they're being disingenuous. The process of genetic engineering is extremely random. The technology is very crude and certainly in its infancy at the moment. I'll give you an idea of how genetic engineering is actually done, and I think that'll give you a sense of just quite what a random process it is. One of the techniques that's used to genetically engineer a plant, for example, with foreign DNA, is a plate covered in plant cells is placed, and then a gun, until recently, I'm not sure if it still is, but until recently it actually used gunpowder, fires tiny pellets of gold or tungsten covered with DNA into that plate covered in plant cells. And some of the time, those tiny pellets will deposit their package of DNA close enough to the chromosome or in the chromosome of those plant cells, and some of the time that DNA will be integrated. But it's a completely hit and miss process. In fact, it's such a hit and miss process, and successful integration of the new DNA is so rare that they need to add a marker gene so they can tell which of those new plant cells have picked up the foreign DNA. And often they include a gene for antibiotic resistance. So they then put all the plant cells that have been shot with these tiny pellets into an antibiotic medium. And the only ones able to survive are the ones that have then picked up the gene for antibiotic resistance, and so also the new DNA. And one of the problems is that very little is actually understood about the ways in which genes operate. Again, you know, people hear newspaper headlines, gene found for intelligence, or gene found for this, or gene found for that. It's far more complex and interesting, of course, than that. In the words of Professor Richard Lewontin, the professor of genetics at Harvard University, he said, quote, "We have such a miserably poor understanding of how an organism develops from its DNA that I would be surprised if we don't get one rude shock after another." One of the ways in which undesirable effects can result from the introduction of the new DNA is because that DNA could end up in the middle of a coding sequence that codes for the production of important chemicals in the organism. And in fact, the FDA's own technical experts, when they were consulted prior to 1992 on the safety issues associated with genetically engineered foods, clearly identified these problems. And yet you have an official policy put out by the Food and Drug Administration in 1992 that was written by a guy called Michael Taylor. Now, Michael Taylor, just prior to his job in the Food and Drug Administration, had been working for King & Spalding, the law firm which represented the biotech company Monsanto, while Monsanto was seeking FDA approval for a genetically engineered bovine growth hormone. And this is just one example of the revolving doors between the biotech industry and the regulatory bodies that are supposed to oversee the biotech industry. And in this official policy statement, the FDA wrote, "The agency is not aware of any information to suggest that foods derived by these new methods differ from other foods in any uniform or meaningful way." And because they thought there was no essential difference between foods produced by genetic engineering or indeed the processes, or indeed the processes of genetic engineering and traditional breeding, they decided that it would actually be up to the biotech companies themselves to decide whether or not they thought there were any safety concerns associated with a genetically engineered product that they wanted to introduce onto the market. Now, prior to 92, as I mentioned earlier, there was an internal review within the Food and Drug Administration on the safety issues associated with genetically engineered foods. And this internal review has only become public knowledge because of a lawsuit taken out against the FDA for its failure to require the safety testing of genetically engineered foods. And Linda Carl, the FDA's compliance officer, summarized the evidence put forward by the toxicologists, the microbiologists, and others within the FDA. She said, "The agency is trying to force a square peg into a round hole by trying to push the ultimate conclusion that the processes are not different and they do not lead to different risks." And she quoted from scientists within the Food and Drug Administration who said that genetically engineered foods could contain new toxins. Genetically engineered foods could contain new proteins that could cause allergic reactions, all of which would not be picked up by the regulatory framework as it stands. A couple of years ago, we heard that Starlet, a variety of genetically engineered corn that hadn't even been approved for human consumption by the US regulatory bodies, and that's really saying something, had turned up in hundreds of products across the supermarket shelves. And the reason they turned up, could have been predicted by anyone who bothers to think about it. Genetically engineered corn, not approved for human consumption, being grown alongside genetically engineered corn that has been approved for human consumption, and indeed a conventional corn that's been approved for human consumption. What do plants do? They produce pollen. Billions of pollen grains fly around in the air. Bees land on plants, transfer pollen. So, of course, you have contamination happening through the normal process of cross-pollination. But you also had contamination because no one bothered to segregate the stuff when it ended up in the grain silos. So it ended up in the food system. So that's one concern. And it cost the industry millions and millions of dollars and a lot of problems. Last December, we heard that something even more serious had taken place. It was found that 500,000 bushels of genetically engineered soybeans. Sorry, 500,000 bushels of soybeans. I don't know if they were genetically engineered. They might have been, because most of the soybean crop in the United States is now. But they've been contaminated with genetically engineered corn that have been, it was one of these pharmaceutical corns that I've been telling you about. They've been contaminated with corn that have been engineered to produce pig vaccine. And the way that it was contaminated is the corn plants engineered to produce a pig vaccine were harvested. Some of the cobs left fell in the ground, sprouted the following year, grew corn plants in amongst the soybean crop that was planted in that field. So when the soybean crop was harvested, you gathered together also the pharmaceutical corn crop with the pig vaccine, ended up in the silo, the whole lot was contaminated. Now this is just one of the incidences that they've admitted to. And you can bet that many other instances have actually taken place. I also done a bit of work in Hawaii, which is one of the main international experimental testing grounds for these pharmaceutical crops. And in fact, they're growing pharmaceutical crops engineered with all kinds of genes, a lot of human genes, genes from animals, right alongside places where they're growing seed corn to plant the corn right the way across the Midwest. So again, it doesn't take a genius to think that there might be some problems coming down the line.
You're listening to American Dream Radio, bringing you British author Luke Anderson and his talk on the underreported battle over genetic engineering, food safety, and the WTO. This talk was given on May 29th, 2003.
Last year, 2001, 50 million hectares of genetically engineered crops were planted in the United States. This is from pretty much none in the mid-90s. 50 million hectares. The vast majority of those genetically engineered crops were crops engineered to be resistant to a company's broad spectrum herbicides. And this is no surprise. And the reason why, of the companies that by the year 2000 controlled 100% of the trade in genetically engineered crops, those five companies also control 60% of the global pesticide market. But we hear that genetic engineering is being done to reduce the use of agricultural chemicals. At least that's what the government and industry propaganda tells us. The industry doesn't want to see a reduction in the use of agricultural chemicals. And in fact, if you look at the USDA statistics, in many cases, agrochemical uses stayed the same. In some cases, they actually increased. With certain crops, they were somewhat reduced. But the industry wants to ensure that farmers are using their chemicals. That's what this is all about. And patent laws give companies the right to demand that a farmer that grows a genetically engineered soybean, for example, one of Monsanto's herbicide-resistant soybeans, only use Monsanto's chemicals. In fact, they can be sued if they use any other chemicals other than the company's own. So it's a pretty neat trick. They sell a genetically engineered crop. They sell it under a contract, which means that that crop has to be grown with the company's own chemicals. And the chemicals for the companies producing herbicide-resistant crops, the sales have soared through the roof. 70% of all the genetically engineered crops that are planted around the world at the moment are those herbicide-resistant crops. And Monsanto actually hired Pinkerton Detective Agency, an agency which traditionally used to provide employers with auxiliaries to break trade unions, to spy on farmers across North America to see if they've been breaking these contracts. They set up three telephone hotlines to encourage farmers to tell on their neighbors if they believe their neighbors were breaking contracts. They offered free leather jackets in advertisements to any farmer that phoned in on one of these hotlines with interesting information. They also broadcast the names of farmers who were caught on local radio stations. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, I don't know the exact number, by 98 or 99, there was about 300 or 400 farmers that had been sued. And their numbers are increasing all the time. So that was about 5 years ago now. In fact, recently, the first farmer went to jail for patent infringement associated with genetically engineered crops. I think a 9-month prison sentence. Perhaps the most famous case of a farmer who was sued by Monsanto is a Canadian canola farmer called Percy Schmeiser. Probably some of you have heard his story. He was a canola farmer who's been growing canola for decades. In fact, prides himself on the production of his own, saving of his own canola seed. The problem is, he says, most of the farms around him are growing genetically engineered canola, and canola pollen readily travels for several kilometers. And this pollen, of course, then when it crosses with canola being grown that's not genetically engineered, that canola will pick up the DNA from the genetically engineered crops. Now, he was sued, according to Monsanto, for illegally planting genetically engineered canola on his land. But he maintains it was there because he was polluted by neighboring farms or by trucks that drive past his farm, dropping seed onto his land. And whether or not he's telling the truth isn't actually even the point here. Because what the judge ruled is that it didn't matter whether or not he planted that on purpose, illegally breaking the contract with you know, in consciousness. The point is, says the judge in Canada, that farmer has the property of Monsanto, the DNA from the genetically engineered canola, on his land, therefore he can be sued by Monsanto. So the polluter is the one who has the right to sue the person who is polluted. And he is now going to the appeals in Canada, and we'll see what happens. Now, patents allow industry to do that when it comes to farmers. But patents actually have far more reaching implications. And patents, probably many of you also know, were first introduced in the United States, I think, by Thomas Jefferson. And inventors were awarded patents that gave them monopoly rights for 17 to 20 years. But until recently, living organisms had always been excluded from patent regimes. In 1980, that was all set to change. The US Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that an employee of General Electric called Chakravarti had the right to patent, as his own invention, a genetically engineered bacteria. Chakravarti was stunned, the supposed inventor. He said, "All I did is shuffle around a few genes, changing a bacteria that already existed." Well, what this patent ruling meant is that in one ruling of the US Supreme Court, the biological commons, the genetic resources of all of life on this planet, had been opened up to companies that had the necessary technology and the necessary capital and the necessary teams of lawyers to file for patents. Patents have been awarded for plants, patents have been awarded for microorganisms, patents have been awarded for animal cell lines and animal DNA, and patents have been awarded for human genes. A company called Biocyte, for example, has a patent on the umbilical cord cells. A company called Systemics has a patent on bone marrow stem cells. A company called Myriad Genetics has a patent on the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 genes, two of the genes associated with breast cancer. In fact, of the 30,000 genes now believed to be in the human genome, over 1,000 of those have already been patented, or patents are pending. A 30th of the human genome. So if, as the biotech industry suggests, and the pharmaceutical industry suggests, the future of medicine is inextricably linked to the advances in understanding of genes and the relationships between genes, chemicals, the environment and other influences, we know who's going to be in control of that medicine. We know who's going to be setting the prices for access to that medicine. And we know who's going to be stopping other people from doing research into the causes of disease. A poll of laboratory directors in December 1999 in the United States found that nearly a quarter of them had already been written to by law firms representing biotech companies, ordering them to stop conducting research into things such as late-onset Alzheimer's disease and breast cancer, because those companies already had patents on the genes central to those diagnostic processes. Over a half of the laboratories polled had voluntarily given up research because they knew a patent had been awarded or was pending. So you can see that patents are stopping people from conducting research. And the medical field, once a field that encouraged the free sharing of information for the good of all, is being turned extremely rapidly into a field of closed and guarded secrets. Another issue associated with patenting is what's called biopiracy, the theft of genetic resources from the countries that are poorest in economic terms, but are richest in terms of genetic diversity. The tropical countries believed to be home to about 95% of the world's biodiversity. And what the biotech industry sees is another opportunity for colonial extraction of resources from the poorest countries of the world. The most famous case is the case of the neem plants which have been used in India for thousands of years and well appreciated for their antibacterial and insecticidal properties. Well, dozens of patents have been awarded for these very same properties to US and Japanese-based seed corporations. US and Japanese-based corporations. Another example, a bush called the Jubilee from the Gabon in West Africa produces a very sweet berry. The University of Wisconsin has taken these berries back to the United States, isolated the ingredient that gives it its sweetness, brazium, and plans to sell it for millions on the lucrative sweetener market. This is just another example. And in fact, the World Trade Organization not only gives corporations the right to do this, to take patents out on countries based on indigenous knowledge of local plants or animals, or what have you, but it enshrines it in international law. And it demands, the World Trade Organization, that every single country that's a signatory to the World Trade Organization introduce laws that protect patents for transnational corporations in any country, right the way across the world, for all the members that are part of the World Trade Organization. Because the United States and European and Japanese-based corporations had a problem. If they got a patent awarded in the United States, they couldn't be sure that it would be respected in Thailand. So they got together, they formed this body called the Intellectual Property Committee, and they went to the World Trade Organization. In the words of Monsanto's James Enyart, who was fairly honest when he described the process whereby these patent laws were introduced into the World Trade Organization, said, the players and traders of world commerce identified a problem, that problem being patents weren't internationalized. So they formed a proposal, reduced it to... So they made a concrete proposal sorry, I can't remember the exact quote. I normally remember this quote. Anyway, what James Enyart said is, in the second part of his quote, is that the industry played the diagnosticians, the physicians, and the patients all in one. They essentially went to the richest countries in the world, said, this is what we want, and it's now enshrined in the World Trade Organization under the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. Biopiracy is a very serious problem. Let me give you a couple more examples. Merck Pharmaceuticals signs an agreement with the Costa Rican government that in exchange for access to all the plants, microorganisms, and animals in the Costa Rican rainforest, and that Costa Rica is believed to be home to about 7% of the world's biodiversity, about 500,000 species. Merck Pharmaceuticals would give the Costa Rican conservation program just over $1 million. Not a lot for a company that earned $8.6 billion that year, worked out at about $2 per species. Plus, they agreed in their generosity to give what was believed to be about 1 to 2% of any royalties that they accrued as a result of a patented product. So, as some people have pointed out, not a lot has changed. Even when there is some flow of resources back to the countries or the peoples from which these genetic resources originate, not a lot has changed since Native Americans were given a few trinkets in exchange for the islands of Manhattan. Patents are also being awarded for whole peoples, exclusive patent rights. An Australian biotech company called Autogen has exclusive patent rights to the entire gene pool of the people of Tonga. Next door to the Tonga only hospital, a research facility is going to be built. Samples will be taken from people admitted to that hospital. Pharmaceuticals will be developed based on the unique genetic characteristics of Pacific Islanders. The biotech industry is very interested in indigenous peoples because they've been relatively isolated from other populations, and therefore certain people suffer from a greater or lesser incidence of particular diseases.
You're listening to American Dream Radio, bringing you British author Luke Anderson and his talk on the underreported battle over genetic engineering, food safety, and the WTO. This talk was given on May 29th,
2003. So, patents. And patents really part of the engine driving the biotech industry. We are witnessing an extremely rapid corporate appropriation of the genetic resources of life on this planet. That equals the appropriation of of all the other public spaces available to us, the lands, the waters, the airways, etc. And really this is one of the reasons why this mobilization in Sacramento is being framed within the context of empire and challenging empire building. Because I think for those of us who are do see things in terms of empire, and certainly the British, where I come from, are strangers to empire. Certainly people who do see things in terms of empire think, well, it's not really enough for people to turn up in their hundreds of thousands at the onset of a military bombing campaign, good as that is. Because in terms of the actual death and destruction in people's lives, what will really show that we get the ways in which our governments oppress the rest of the people in the world, but keep people under the heel of empire, on a day-to-day basis, exceed the number of deaths caused by any bombing campaign. 30,000 people die every single day at the moment from hunger. In a world which, according to the United Nations, produces 1.5 times enough food to feed everyone in the world with an adequate nutritious diet. Someone dies from hunger every 2.6 seconds. 3/4 of those are children under the age of 5. We're overproducing food, and yet we've got 30,000 people dying every single day from hunger. And that's day after day after day. Not only that, but our governments not just supporting and defending, but enforcing aggressively an economic system that maintains the status quo. And the status quo means death and destruction in ordinary people's lives all around the planet. It's one of the reasons why people's movements and peasant farmers groups from around the world have called on people in the United States to protest at this meeting in Sacramento. Via Campesina, for example, represents 40 million peasant farmers around the world. They called on people in the United States to protest at this meeting in Sacramento. Because even though backroom deals might seem less dangerous than cruise missiles and guns, they are no less dangerous in terms of their impact on ordinary people's lives. In fact, Arundhati Roy was being interviewed on Democracy Now! A couple of weeks ago. And she said, there are a number of ways in which empire spreads its tentacles. One is with the cruise missiles and the daily cutters. The other is with the checkbook. And the checkbook, the backroom deals that are represented by the kind of meeting that is taking place in Sacramento, is really one of the wars that needs to be confronted if we're serious about turning empire around and turning this country and facing and walking together in a radically new direction. Genetic engineering, I've talked a little bit about the human health concerns. One of the things that of course concerns people perhaps more than the human health effects of genetic engineering are the effects on the environment of releasing new living organisms into complex ecosystems. It represents a whole new order of pollution. Some have said even worse than the hazards associated with nuclear pollution, because even nuclear pollution has a half-life, whereas living organisms, once released, many of them will never be able to be recalled, and they will replicate themselves, and they will transfer that DNA to related species. I'll give a few examples of environmental consequences associated with genetically engineered organisms to give you a sense of just how serious the effects could be. Some scientists at Oregon State University heard about a genetically engineered bacterium that was sailing its way through the approval process in the United States. And this was a genetically engineered bacterium that had been engineered to turn crop waste into ethanol. And it sounded like a good idea. Instead of burning the crop waste, the farmer would gather it together, put it in a vat in a fermenter, add the genetically engineered bacteria. It would produce ethanol as a byproduct that could then be used as a fuel. And the sludge that was left over would be added to fields as the soil amendment. But what they hadn't bothered to do is test this genetically engineered bacterium in living soil systems. They just tested it on sterile soil. stuff make a lot of sense, because soil is a living, breathing mass of microorganisms which are vital to a plant's ability to uptake nutrients. And these are scientists at Oregon State University devised pretty simple ecological models to see what the consequences could be on real living systems of the release of this genetically engineered bacteria. And they found, to their horror, that in the case of sandy soils containing wheat plants, not only did this genetically engineered bacteria kill the plants outright, but had led to a reduction by about a half of the beneficial microorganisms in the soil. And Elaine Ingham, one of the chief scientists involved in this research, maintains to this day that unless her team, independent scientists, voluntarily requesting to conduct this research, had done the research that they did, the first that we would have likely heard about this is when this stuff was added as a soil amendment across North American farmland. Very difficult to recall a genetically engineered microorganism. Genetically engineered fish are being made in about 50 laboratories around the world at the moment. Usually to engineer fish to be more efficient, better suited to intensive aquaculture production facilities. Engineered to grow faster, of course always seeking ever greater profits. Engineering the fish to grow faster, sometimes engineering them to tolerate colder waters so that the fish farms can move further north. The first genetically engineered animal probably to end up on Americans' dinner plates is probably going to be a genetically engineered salmon or a catfish. And we know that from conventional intensive aquaculture production, fish frequently escape in their thousands from fish farms. In single instances in the past years, there have been releases of hundreds of thousands of fish when storms have torn apart the cages or sea lions have torn apart the cages, resulting in major problems for native salmon populations, even with in conventional intensive salmon farming. But if a genetically engineered fish is kept in a similar kind of sea cage, we can expect that they will transfer their characteristics and they will start breeding with native fish populations. Some scientists at the University of Purdue here in the United States use computer models to look at a variety of fast-growing genetically engineered fish and to see what would happen if that genetically engineered fish were released into a wild population. And for the purposes of this computer model, they looked at what would happen with the release of 60 genetically engineered fish into a wild population of 60,000. Now, this genetically engineered fish have been engineered to grow faster, and so the fish were bigger, and because of their larger size, they were more attractive to mates. So they gathered together more of the mates from the wild fish population in comparison with the other fish. But for some reason, as a result of the genetic engineering process, their offspring were less likely to survive, were less likely to be viable. There are frequently effects like this associated with genetic engineering. So what this actually meant is that the fish that would produce the less healthy offspring were the ones that would take more of the mates. And this led to a local extinction using this computer model of the wild and the genetically engineered fish population over just 40 generations. And it shows just how stunning and unexpected some of the potential consequences could be. Here we are in Mendocino County. A lot of people feel fairly strongly about trees. Whatever your viewpoint, you might be interested to know about plans to introduce genetically engineered trees into forestry in the next few years. They are genetically engineering trees much in the same way as they are food crops to be resistant to herbicides, sometimes engineered to produce their own toxins to target insects, sometimes being engineered to grow faster. International Paper is a company that's supporting the development of genetically engineered trees that have altered lignin content. So that is trees with a lower level of lignin, which is the substance that gives plants its hardness, so that they're more suitable for processing into pulp for the papermaking industry. because lignin is one of the substances that takes quite a lot of chemicals to break down the lignin. So these are the kinds of things that we could be seeing, and the problems are associated with cross-pollination from genetically engineered forests, even those associated with genetically engineered crops. Pollen was found in Rajasthan, in the desert in northwest India, for example. It came from trees in the Himalayas, 650 kilometers away. So genetically engineered pollen from genetically engineered forests travel considerable distances. And of course, even plantation forests are very close to the wild state of the trees. So the likelihood of large amounts of genetic pollution, the transfer of genetically engineered DNA to the wild relatives, is also a major problem. This is all part, I'm just giving you a sense of what the United States vision for agricultural development involves. And this is all part of it. One of the arguments used to promote genetic engineering again and again, and certainly in the advertisements that broadcast across networks in the United States, the biotech industry is spending $50 billion a year at the moment in public relations, even just on one initiative, which is the broadcast of certain advertisements promoting genetic engineering. And in fact, they've been very successful at securing coverage for the pro-biotech argument right the way across the US corporate media. And one of the stories that they got most coverage of, that was on the front pages of most of the main respected newspapers, was genetically engineered golden rice. Now, this so-called golden rice was engineered to have high levels of beta-carotene in it, which is what the body turns into vitamin A. And this miracle rice, we were told, was going to save hundreds of thousands of people from blindness across the poorest countries of the world. People who suffer from blindness due to vitamin A deficiency. And Bill Clinton even gave a speech about this in which he said that getting more of this rice to the third world would save the lives of thousands of children a day. Well, on closer inspection, if you actually look at the detail of this genetically engineered rice, you'll find out that the beta-carotene is being produced in such low levels in this genetically engineered rice that an adult would need to eat 9 kilograms every single day to get their recommended daily allowance of vitamin A. Hardly, I would suggest, a practical solution. Especially when you compare that with recommended daily allowance of vitamin A to be found in just a handful of dark green vegetables.
You're listening to American Dream Radio, bringing you British author Luke Anderson and his talk on the underreported battle over genetic engineering, food safety, and the WTO. This talk was given on May 29th, 2003.
Now this example of the poster child of the biotech industry really serves to illustrate an important point. Hunger is not caused through lack of food, nor is it caused through lack of some kind of technological fix. Poverty is what means that people are suffering from vitamin A deficiency. And an economic system that guarantees to keep people poor so that we in the West can be excessively rich. If you have a look at some of the details, some of the reasons why people are suffering from hunger, take a look at world debt, something I'm sure a lot of you have looked at before. According to World Bank and OECD statistics, third world countries pay every single day in debt, in 1997, $836.2 million to banks in the West. For every dollar given in aid to the so-called third world, they pay back over $6 in debt. And over a third of this debt is just servicing the interest on their loans. Now, what were these loans all about, these World Bank loans that the United States and other governments say they have to pay back, these poor countries have to pay back? It simply wouldn't be right to just forgive these debts. Well, these loans were given by our banks and our governments to corrupt regimes in the global south. What for? to finance massive dam building projects. Who got the contracts for those dam building projects? Corporations based in our countries, of course. So it was a way of paying ourselves and producing something completely inappropriate for those countries. What else did we give them loans for? Anyone take a guess? Yeah, to buy weapons. Guess who sold them the weapons? We did. Guess what happened with those weapons? Lots of people got killed, and horrific regimes managed to continue to allow the colonial-style extraction of the wealth and the intelligence and other resources from those countries, both to corrupt elites in those countries and to the governments that support them and maintain them and keep them in control. So the International Monetary Fund then steps into those countries and says, oh, well, now that you're crippled by debt and you owe us a lot of money, it's no longer appropriate for you to subsidize basic food production. It's no longer appropriate for you to be growing food to feed your own population. You now need to be growing cash crops for export so that you can generate income, so that you can pay us for the money we lent you, so that you can buy weapons from us, so that we can make lots of money. Ethiopia, for example, in the 1984 Ethiopian famine, was using its best agricultural land, a lot of its best agricultural land, to grow cotton seed, linseed, and oilseed grain. What for? To feed livestock markets in Europe. During the famine, in which thousands and thousands and thousands were killed, Ethiopia was also exporting fruit, meat, and vegetables. Brazil, by the mid-90s, ranked as the world's third largest food exporter, yet 70 million Brazilians haven't got enough to eat. And this all makes perfect sense, apparently. This is free trade. This is going to feed the world, this kind of a system. Yes, we've led to increases in food production through intensive industrial agriculture. But the food hasn't ended up on the plates of the people that need it. South America, for example, between 1970 and 1990, there was an 8% increase in per capita food production in South America. Yet in that same time period, there was a 19% increase in the number of people who went hungry. Why? Because you've got a global commodity trading system, you've got pressure from bodies such as the World Bank and the IMF to grow cash crops for export, that mean that countries with starving populations are exporting food and not feeding themselves. So this all needs to change if we're serious about feeding people. What else needs to change? Access to land. One of the biggest problems, meaning that the poorest people aren't able to grow food to feed themselves. 8 out of 10 farmers in Central America don't have access to enough land on which to feed their families. And yet huge areas of land go unplanted. Why? Because they're held by rich landowners. Again, this all makes perfect sense, but you know, redistribution of land, of course, isn't a very sacred concept within a capitalist system. You know, property rights are far more important than the rights of people to feed their families. Yet even the World Bank's own studies show that redistribution of land into smaller units would be the single best way to increase food production. Studies from the Food and Agricultural Organization show that smaller units are many, many times more productive than larger farms. Smaller units, which are more intensively cultivated, by intensively in this case I mean more carefully cultivated, can be cultivated with a mixture of different crops. These are the ways that people are going to get access to food. And in some countries, people are taking their future into their own hands and reclaiming land. In Brazil, for example, there's the landless peasants movement, which has been occupying land that's completely unused, but held by large ranches. And they've been planting it, they've been growing food, they've been selling that food, they've been making their own schools, they've been making their own cottage industries, and they've been forming entire villages. And all they needed to do that was freedom to self-organize and freedom to get access to land.
We have all the tools available to us if we're interested in feeding people. Jules Pretty from the University of Essex released a report in the year 2000, which was the largest ever survey of sustainable agricultural practices around the world. They surveyed 4.42 million farmers farming in many of the poorest countries of the world. And he found that when farmers switched from chemically intensive agricultural practices and other practices to a range of sustainable organic agricultural practices, such as cover crops and legumes, livestock integration, there was a 73% increase in household food production. 73%. That is far in excess of anything that the biotech industry is even suggesting, even in its propaganda. And so this is all something that we can do. So it's one of the reasons why some of the strongest resistance to genetic engineering, and in fact other aspects of free trade agriculture, has come from the poorest countries, is because they've been here before. They heard all these arguments. They heard that industrial agriculture was going to lead to an end in hunger within a decade. 1 in 7 people in the world now suffering from hunger. And so promises that genetic engineering is some kind of panacea, they see as nothing more than an attempt to allow the governments and industries that really are complicit and really are creating and maintaining the social systems and the economic systems that keep people hungry. It really doesn't fool anyone when Ann Veneman, the U.S. Agriculture Secretary, who used to work for Monsanto, by the way, announces that this Sacramento ministerial taking place next month is all about the United States sharing the benefits of its wisdom, the benefits of its innovative agricultural technologies with the countries of the global south so that they can all be fed. Just a few weeks ago, the United States was the only country in the world, the only one, to vote against the human right to food. The only country in the world to vote against the human right to food. And the United States does not believe, like the rest of the world, that when they give food aid, you should give cash so that the country has the right to buy the food that's most culturally appropriate, or most locally sourced, or the cheapest. The United States believes that countries don't have the right to refuse their food aid, and what is it that they're giving them for food aid? They're giving them the genetically engineered crops that they aren't able to sell on international markets. Why aren't they able to sell them on international markets? Because most of the world doesn't want them. European Union, which, by the way, is filled mostly with governments and bureaucrats that are supportive of an agricultural future that includes genetic engineering, but that was forced by massive opposition from the populations in those countries to create more regulatory frameworks to at least begin to look at some of the huge and serious issues associated with genetic engineering. Anyway, the United States believes that the Europeans don't have the right to make their own decisions through their own very faulty democratic processes as to whether or not they want to allow genetically engineered foods to be planted in their own countries. No, that's not allowed. It's not allowed for African countries to decide for themselves that they don't want to have genetically engineered food aid because they don't want to see what happened in Mexico, happening in their countries. In Mexico, food aid shipments of corn ended up being planted. Genetically engineered corn now has contaminated the country, which is the world's origin of corn diversity. African countries didn't want to see that happen. And in fact, they even asked the Americans, oh, well, I'll tell you what, you know, some of us might accept this food aid because, you know, we've got a real problem here, if you'll be prepared to admit it, so that our farmers won't be able to plant it. Oh no. The biotech industry and the governments that are promoting genetic engineering, it is absolutely in their interest to see conventional food supplies, non-genetically engineered food supplies, contaminated. Why? Because then there's no alternative. If they can get contamination happening to such an extent that what will the Europeans be able to do? What will anyone be able to do to say, we don't want to eat genetically engineered foods? A report came out from a Washington, D.C. based food firm called, sorry, food consulting firm called Promar International. And they said, quote, the hope of the food industry is that over time the market becomes so flooded with GMOs that there's nothing you can do about it. You just sort of surrender. Well, people around the world are simply not willing to surrender. Like I mentioned, in the African countries there's been very strong resistance to genetic engineering. In the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, which came out of the Rio Earth Summit, there was an attempt to set up an international regulatory framework to try to protect biodiversity from effects from genetically engineered organisms. And the United States, together with Canada and Australia, Chile, Uruguay, and Argentina, six countries in the world, did their best to destroy this agreement. Why? Because they thought that it was concerns raised by African countries in particular and others that, hold on a minute, if you governments and you biotech industry are telling us that this is safe, why is it then, you know, here we are trying to write an agreement which would include an international liability regime that would hold you liable if we get any problems? But of course, you know, you shouldn't worry about that because you know this is safe because you've done all the testing, right? So why is it that you're fighting against an international liability regime that would mean that we get some kind of compensation? Tabolda Exeoka, the head of the Ethiopian delegation, said, why should we, the poorest countries of the world, be expected to bear the risks of the experimentation of the richest? Because what the biotech industry is doing now with these pharmaceutical crops, because there's such a lot of controversy, is it trying to find out-of-the-way places in the third world where it can do these experiments in countries which don't even have the bare, like, even idea of a regulatory framework to protect the environment or human health from genetically engineered organisms. And Monsanto came to the UK in 1998 with a big advertising campaign, and they said, slowing the acceptance of biotechnology is a luxury the hungry world cannot afford in these adverts. It so happened that as these advertisements came out in the British press, there was a meeting in Rome at the Food and Agricultural Organization, and the African delegates representing their countries at this meeting were so outraged at the statements being made on their behalf that they decided to issue a formal statement of their own to the press, and they said, quote, this was signed by 24 delegates from 18 African countries, we strongly object to the image of the poor and hungry from our countries being used by giant multinational corporations to push a technology that we believe is neither safe, environmentally friendly, nor economically beneficial to us. So the African countries really spearheaded this move under the United Nations to build an international regulatory framework. And that now exists. It's soon to be ratified. It's been signed by a lot of countries around the world. So you've got an agreement under the United Nations that specifically gives countries the right to refuse imports of genetically engineered foods. What is happening right now? What has the United States just done? The Bush administration just announced its 60-day notice, which is a notice in the run-up to a WTO action against the European Union, for what? For the European Union's continued failure to allow the commercial approval of new genetically engineered crops. Because the European Union is tied up in this pesky thing called democratic process whereby they're trying to set some rules in place before they allow any more commercial approval. So the United States, of course, has complete lack of regard for other countries' democratic process. And so it's going to take this to the World Trade Organization, a completely undemocratic body. You have a bunch of men sitting in the dark room, no one knows, that aren't elected, and they're going to make the decision. They're going to make the decision that's going to affect the future of this world's food supply. They're going to make the decision that's going to affect the ability of countries around the world to say no to organisms that are going to damage their health and their environment. Because this, the World Trade Organization, is freedom. This, the World Trade Organization, is progress. That is why people are protesting in Sacramento. For all of these reasons that I've been talking about, we are protesting in Sacramento. We will be standing there, whether we're in our thousands or our tens of thousands or whatever, and we will be doing our best to confront this empire building, to confront these backroom deals, to say enough, to say it is not okay to continue with business as usual. And are we in the United States, those of us who live here, willing to make the effort to go to these places, to take advantage of these opportunities, to confront what this government is doing in the name of the people in this room and in this country, to the people who live elsewhere in the world, and the organisms and the beings and the plants and the seas that we share this planet with? That is why we're mobilizing Sacramento, and I encourage you all to come along.
Comprises the World Trade Organization as a country, its government,
its capitalist? It's, well, basically the corporations lobby the richest and most powerful countries in the world for the kind of rules that they want to see. And you don't really need a conspiracy theory to deal with it, because you know, the elites in the richest countries in the world, and in fact in many of the other countries around in the world, are one and the same as the corporations that are lobbying. They just kind of go round and round and shift from job to government post from year to year. And so they create rules that will continue to benefit their own interests. That's essentially what it is.
Are they like CEOs or what kind of people?
It is every country that's a member of the World Trade Organization essentially creates the World Trade Organization. It's an ongoing process that's come through from the GATT negotiations, and it is still being discussed. They're still attempting to write the rules, to reach these agreements, and in particular the agreement on agriculture, what a lot of people say is the Achilles heel of the World Trade Organization. Which, you know, you've got a very clear agenda being set by some countries in the world, one which is all about the kind of things that I've been discussing. But, you know, it's very hard to get agreement on agriculture, you know, even between the United States and the European Union, even though they share a lot of the same interests, you know, in terms of like maintaining their economic dominance in the global system.
I just wanted to make one statement in relation to what you got pretty close to talking about Africa, particularly being imposed to genetically engineered food. Some of you have probably seen these emails on the internet, but one of the things in a public relations sense that the Bush administration has done is come out with this big AIDS drug thing, and one of the blackmail components of this is they're not going to be giving these AIDS drugs to countries that refuse genetically engineered agricultural products. So it's getting a lot of PR and a lot of like Bush is out to help the world kind of attitude to it, but there's definitely a price tag involved in it, and it's the blackmailing these people into relating to this genetically modified organisms.
You're listening to American Dream Radio. We have brought you British author Luke Anderson and his talk on the underreported battle over genetic engineering, food safety, and the WTO, given on May 29, 2003. Mr. Anderson is the author of the best-selling book, Genetic Engineering, Food and Our Environment. This public talk was sponsored by the Ukiah Valley Alliance for Democracy in Ukiah, California, on May 29, 2003. It took place about 3 weeks before a planned meeting of the agricultural ministers of the WTO on June 23rd through the 25th, 2003, in Sacramento, California. This is an original production of American Dream Radio. Rights are granted for rebroadcast by non-commercial parties only. To learn more about American Dream Radio, find us on the web at www.americandreamradio.org. To find out more about the upcoming WTO protest in Sacramento, on the web, go to www.sacmobilization.org. That's SACmobilization.org.